Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Media in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you for joining us. Our guests are Paul Jenkins of the Anchorage Daily Planet, Steve McDonald of Channel 2 News, and Nathaniel Hertz of the Alaska Dispatch News. Paul, the great yes-no debate is over. What happened to the referendum and why?
Ballot measure one failed 52-47, or 52-247-7, if you will. It did very well in South Central and Kenai. It didn't do so well in Fairbanks or in the Southeast. I think in Fairbanks it was...
I think you got it the other way around. The yes did well in Fairbanks and...
Yeah, no did not do well in Fairbanks.
Okay.
Right, I'm sorry. I'm confused on the damn thing.
So, as long as you know how you voted.
Let me see. How did I vote?
Maybe.
Anyway, so it was fairly close in the early counting, and then it kind of spread out. They expect, I think, eventually that the no's will be out front, 53-54, to whatever, 47, 46, 47.
And there's estimates of something like 14,000, 15,000 votes.
I think we were talking about that earlier. We'll call it 15, round numbers, up or down. The interesting thing to me is this kind of crossed party lines. Democrats, districts you would think would go Democrat and vote yes. Bill Wielichowski's district, Hollis French's district, Chris Duck's district, they all voted no. 55-45, 60-40, that kind of thing. So it was, the yes side picked up conservative Republicans. I don't know who expected that. The no side picked up some probably moderate, middle-of-the-road Democrats. We did very well in Anchorage.
Okay. Steve, let's talk about the role of the money in this campaign. As we know, it was quite a disparate spending.
The no side had millions and millions of dollars in this race, and you could see evidence of that in all the ads that were on TV, full-page ads in the newspaper, lots of ads on radio as well. Outspent the yes side by a wide, wide margin. You would think by the amount of money that was spent, you would think that it would be a wide margin of victory for the no side, and that just didn't materialize. I guess they should be happy by the fact that they won. So that's what we wanted to do. We spent a lot of money, and we won.
There's no point in leaving it in the bank. That's what they say in campaigns.
That's right. It doesn't do you any good there. Now there's kind of a debate, a little one going, is this a bulletproof margin of victory? Is this a confirmation of what the governor and the legislature did in approving SB 21. If you talk to the folks who were trying to repeal this thing, they say no. It was so close that it's obvious that the state is evenly divided on this, and I don't think this debate's over yet.
Nat, did you want to add something?
Yeah, I was just going to say. I mean, it's interesting. I'm not a pollster. I didn't do a poll, but I did spend a little bit of time outside a polling place on Tuesday, and we were trying to get some people to just talk to us a little bit about how they made up their minds on the Senate race, the referendum, and on the issue of money. It was interesting. There were a few people who said, I voted yes simply because I was sick and tired of having these oil companies trying to tell me how to make up my mind. And so it sort of, to me, like raises the question, at what point, when you're spending a huge amount of money, do you get, at a certain point, do you get A, diminishing returns, or B, counterproductive? I don't know if it really hit that point, because maybe there were a lot of people
And this does point to the fact that anywhere you go, there are a certain part of the population that's negatively suggestible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. So, Steve, 35% turnout looks like we're going to get maybe a little bit more than that. That means 65% of the people stayed home.
Yeah, that's right. I have no explanation for why voter turnout's so low. I think this is kind of one of those hardy perennials that we discuss here in the program after an election.
Usually with a lament. It's okay if you lament.
Yeah, I'm lamenting. But 33% came out in 2010. It was a similar primary then. You had a governor's race. You had a senator's race. this time you had the added feature of Proposition 1, plus you had a barn burner of a Republican primary for the U.S. Senate. Wasn't the weather, unless it was too hot to vote or too sunny to vote, or they didn't want to come in and vote because
I warned you some
nice
people
outside.
Are negatively suggestible.
I don't know what the answer is, but obviously this is something that the states and the city of Anchorage, because city of Anchorage, when it holds its municipal elections, it's the same kind of thing.
20%.
Exactly. And these are really important decisions that are being made by a fraction of the populace. So perhaps the state needs to sit down and they need to go through their options using technology much more than it does now. Washington State uses email and the internet and has great returns usually, great participation by voters. That's something I think Alaska's going to have to look at.
Well, then you have California had 18% in their primary this year. Iowa had less than 10%. The national average was very poor. And actually, this primary election, the turnups the largest since 2008, when first time Obama ran and Ted Stevens and Begich were running.
You know, and maybe too. We look to Washington D.C. We blame everything that happens in Washington, but you look at the discourse that comes out of there, the gridlock, the name calling, the lack of leadership that's coming out of all three branches of government, or at least two out of three, and that's probably had a lot to do with it too. People have turned off.
Paul, you have something to add here?
But is it name calling if it's true? That's the question.
Okay.
The spread between the yes and no vote was something like what, 8,800, 8,600, something like that. I had the number. I sat down and did the math. If you take that against the state population, the difference between the yes and the no is like 0.009%.
Yeah. Well, here's something that just for fun, I did some of the homework on election districts and how they voted, and I'll go through a few of them for you. Let's take starting in Southeast Alaska, which went yes quite demonstrably. Angoon Sitka, that area, 2353 yes, 1133 no, but only a 26% turnout. Ketchikan, 1697 yes, 1407 no, but only a 25% turnout. I suggest that these people were voting yes in Southeast Alaska because they are not so much beneficiaries, in fact, probably rarely so, of people who work on the pipeline or are directly employed by Alyeska or the pipe companies, but benefit from the Treasury.
Yeah, they get a permanent fund dividend check, and they don't have to pay a state income tax
or a statewide
sales tax. So everybody in the state does benefit from the oil industry in some way.
Well, that's true. I was just thinking that they are probably perhaps less direct in the sense that they don't have a job up north that their companies.
Right. And there are no oil rigs in the
southeast. Right.
Okay, and let's take a look at Bethel, the Bethel region, 1,456 yes, 1,396 no. That's almost a 50-50 split with 29%. Turnout. I was fascinated to note that the village of Kipnuk voted yes and the village of Napaskiak voted no. And why these small villages would break in this way is we need a brilliant young political scientist to go out there and do the homework. Finally, in Nome and Barrow, the Nome 30, which is the center of the House District 39, 1484 yes, 1630 no. So that's on the no side a little bit, 32% turnout or 31.45, and Barrow, the North Slope, where the local regional corporation and others came out in opposition to the referendum, 1,001 yes, 1,727 no, with about a 32% turnout. So that's a brief report on turnout issues. Mm-hmm. Nat, let's get you in here full scale and full bore. Welcome. You covered the Senate race more closely than perhaps anybody, and certainly anybody at this table. First, tell us about the GOP results.
Dan Sullivan won.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, you know, you had a lot of people, I think going into Election Day, you had a lot of people who said, we think Dan Sullivan is going to win, but we would be stupid if we really said we didn't think there was a chance of Joe Miller pulling one off. And in the end, you know, the last poll that I saw that was conducted August 16th to August 18th, with Election Day being the 19th, had this was done by Dittman Research, and it was no more than a point or two off, saying, you know, Sullivan 40, Miller 32, and Mr. Treadwell with the remainder. So, you know, I think it sort of, it came out with the result that I think a lot of people were expecting, even though there was some uncertainty. You know, it was pretty clear that Joe Miller really seemed to be surging at the end. And, you know, I think you can get differing interpretations about whether that was based on what his campaign was doing or whether that was based on what Put Alaska First, which is the pro-Mark Begich super PAC, was doing, really going after Dan Sullivan and Mead Treadwell towards the end of the election. And then you also had the allegation from at least one, maybe a couple people, that the super PAC actually was running some negative Miller ads really up to the end of the election that seemed to maybe be designed to actually make Miller look a little better to conservatives, because they were kind of attacking him from the center, saying, you know, Miller doesn't support abortion, Miller wants to impeach the president. Is that really going to hurt you that badly in the Republican primary? Who knows? So those are a few observations.
And I think one of the things that this indicates, then I'd ask you, is that doesn't this indicate that there is a, within the Republican Party, there may not be a majority of people who are Tea Party people or close to it, but there certainly is a strong plurality of people who really believe in Joe Miller's message.
Yeah. I mean, you know, he was, there were a lot of really enthusiastic supporters he had out with him. You know, I talked to the polling place I went to, it was like 4 or 5 out of 6 of the people I asked said it, people who voted in the Republican primary said they voted for Joe. So it was definitely, you know, I think one of the things that people see in him is he is, regardless of what you think about his beliefs, he's at least really firm in them. You know where he stands. You know, the people I talk to.
This is the stand-up guy business, right? Yeah. He's a stand-up guy, whatever else you say about him.
Mm-hmm. I don't really know what stand-up guy means, but yes, I think, you know, you know what you're getting with Joe Miller. And I think he was, I mean, it's hard to say whether he was successful or not, but he's, you know, certainly raised a lot of questions about the positions of his opponents and the consistency of their positions, you know, between when they entered the election and the positions they'd espoused during the campaign, as opposed to what they'd said in their previous roles, you know, whether that's in a
state. Steve, I have one thing for you. Thank you on that. The stand-up guy business with Joe Miller. A friend of mine saw this. I did not see it, where Miller and Bede Treadwell were debating, and they were asked about impeaching Obama, the president of the United States, and Miller said, unsurprisingly, yes, this was a top priority. This is something I made up my mind on. And Bede Treadwell explained that, well, he couldn't comment on it because he might have to sit in judgment at a future time, and he'd reserve judgment till that time. From a campaign point of view, from the audience point of view, Miller's answer is much better at turning votes than I'll think about it.
Right. Yeah. No. That's exactly right. And I think Nathaniel alluded to it. He is consistent with his message. He's very articulate. He's very commanding. He's a commanding presence when you're watching him debate. And I think I have a hard time thinking of any political candidate here in Alaska who's better than him when it comes to debating. He looks right in the eye. He speaks from his heart, and I don't know anybody who's better than Joe Miller at delivering a message and debating. There may be somebody out there that I haven't thought of, but he truly is good, and he's very charismatic. And yes, you ask him a question, you are going to get an answer. You're not going to get something that's
final
politically correct.
Final question here, Ned. Do we have a sense of what's next for Joe Miller?
You know, we really don't. I did an interview with Dan Sullivan on Wednesday, the day after the election. Dan said that he had a coffee planned with Joe Miller that afternoon. I put in a couple calls that day to Joe's campaign manager, to Joe's spokesperson. Zero was the response there, and haven't heard, you know, a single message from them. I mean, to be fair, haven't heard a single message from Mead Treadwell either. You know, I think you saw
when you lose, you're hard to find.
Yeah, exactly. I think you saw during the campaign, it seemed like Dan Sullivan's staff and Joe Miller's staff seemed to be taking real care to sort of preserve an amicable relationship there. And, you know, you saw towards the end of the campaign where Miller actually switched from his, I'm not going to necessarily support the Republican nominee, I might be an independent, to being very much, you know, I will support the Republican nominee, maybe encourage, he was even encouraging the Libertarian candidate
and,
at one point.
Paul, I think that has to be because he sees that in his interest, pretty elemental.
Well,
there,
I think
right?
what he did in this election was take a long step away from the last election. I think he's rehabbing his credentials. He's looking down the road, to me, and I'm just guessing, I think he's looking down the road. There's congressional seat going to open up someday.
Hey, let's look down this road. The governor's race wasn't nearly as exciting or full of drama as when you have people running unopposed or essentially unopposed. It's not true they were unopposed, the Democrats and Republicans.
Well,
what did we learn
there
from the primary, if anything?
I don't know what we learned. There were 86,000 Republican votes cast and 52,000 Democratic votes, and the governor racked up 75% of the Republican votes. And beyond that, I don't know. Rope-a-dope works. We'll see if it works when we get into the general election contest. Despite a lot of animosity pointed at him, he's got a pretty solid following among Republicans.
Okay, Steve, headline. Mm-hmm. Walker Malone urged to unite against Parnell. This is
Malott.
Byron Malott,
Democratic candidate.
Yeah. What do you make of that?
Well, that was a surprise to hear that. This is coming from the AFL-CIO, major union, obviously, here in Alaska. And basically, they're saying, well, we really don't have a dog in this fight unless something else happens. We want to see Bill Walker, Byron Malott, form one ticket. That would mean that Mr. Fleener and Hollis French would have to get off the ticket as lieutenant gubernatorial candidates and go after Parnell. Conventional wisdom, I can remember, you know, months ago when we were all speculating that, well, a three-way race, this would benefit Byron Malott because you would have Bill Walker, who's running as an independent, but he's a Republican. He would take votes away from Sean Parnell, and this would benefit Malott, the Democrat, which is how Tony Knowles got elected back in the early 90s in a three-way race. Now the conventional wisdom basically says, you know, it would be Malott and Walker siphoning votes away from themselves.
Yeah, and here's what struck me, that the idea of them getting together, it's possible, just as you indicated,
because
we have an example, and the people who did that, Hickel and Coghill, won.
That's probably what
officials would notice.
Right.
But at the same time, it just seems to me that Walker and Malott have such strong egos. If this was going to happen, it should have happened a long time ago.
Yeah, well, in the Daily News, the Daily Dispatch, old
Dispatch
habits
News.
Yeah.
Just ADN.
ADN, I have to go with that. I'm thinking of the old ways. ADN quoted Malott as basically saying that no way, no day am I going to do this. I'm in it for the long haul. So I just don't see that happening. I think you're right on that, Michael.
Do you want to add anything here?
To me, if they did it, it's a kiss of death. Okay, union tells you what your ticket's going to be. Mm-hmm. It's problematic for them among the electorate, I think. If they do it, people are going to say, well, you know, hey, listen, the union's going to run these guys. And I think that it would come back to bite them.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Nathaniel, another headline, No Rest for the Weary. Challenger Dan Sullivan and incumbent Mark Begich, they don't wait very long to get back hard at it. And quite clearly, they already had advertisements made up anticipating they were going to win and who their opponent was going to be.
Yeah, I mean, in retrospect, I don't even know if it's right to say go back to work, because going back to work implies that they stopped at some point. I think, you know, they got done with the primary night. We went home 1 o'clock a.m., I think, you know. Dan said he got home, I think, between 1 and 2, and then the next day was the first day of school. And, you know, he wakes up to, like, 5 Democratic press releases saying, welcome to the race, Dan Sullivan, here are all of your problems. ad campaign from the Democratic super PAC attacking him for his stance not opposing Pebble Mine, whether or not he supported it. And then, you know, on the other side, you have That same day, Mark Begich doing his campaign kickoff, and then yesterday you had Americans for Prosperity, the group that was founded by the Koch brothers, going after him with the really sort of slickly produced, catchy ad that, you know, it just sort of, it's on, and, you know, whether it was off at any point, you can...
And the essence of that particular ad is?
That ad had him accused Sorry?
It was the wages one?
No. So that one was from American Crossroads. So this is the thing. It's like, you know, you've got like 15 different groups. So there's American Crossroads. That's the Karl Rove group. Mm-hmm. Then you've got Americans for Prosperity. So Crossroads did an ad attacking him over alleged pay differential between men and women members of his official staff. And then yesterday, Americans for Prosperity ran an ad. It featured this guy who runs the Rainy Pass Lodge saying Mark Begich doesn't show up to work because Mark Begich missed 12 votes last year, which their figures were correct. They did not include the context of Senator Murkowski missed, I think, 19 votes, and Don Young missed a lot more votes than that. So, you know.
And that was in the House, of course, which there would be a different number of votes.
Yeah, but there were many more votes, but, you know. Yeah, so definitely getting
and started. Begich today, or one of the, it is him actually, because he does the disclaimer.
Yep.
Is saying runs an ad which is outtakes from the debates of the Republican challengers who lost, attacking Dan Sullivan.
The alternative title is why Republicans should stick to the Reagan's 11th commandment of not attacking other Republicans.
And one of the things that I got sent from somebody back east. Soon as I got up Wednesday morning was a headline from the Cleveland Plain Dealer.
I think the headline was Cleveland area native Dan Sullivan wins Alaska Senate primary. I don't know what Democrat paid them to put up that headline, but I hope it was a lot of money. I don't know. I mean, that was.
Well, we have to assure the audience. We think the copy desk of the Cleveland Plain Dealer just has called it like they saw it. But this is really the local angle, right? Yeah. Local man,
hometown
and that's what Dan Sullivan
good.
Doesn't want to be in Cleveland. This local
he doesn't want to be the hometown boy that makes good.
Okay, Paul. Two state house members incumbents were defeated. One in South Central Alaska and one in Fairbanks. Why don't you take a quick look at them?
The Fairbanks North Pole area one, Tammy Wilson versus Doug Isaacson. I guess that was a redistricting battle. They were wound up running against each other in the primary. Wilson takes that 55-45. And down in the Mat-Su, we've got Eric Feige, and he was running against George Rauscher. And then a Union-backed Jim Culver jumped in. And at the end of the day, we've got Culver out front, 38%, Feige behind him with 30, and Rauscher at 31%. So,
actually, what's going to be? Did
Feige
finish third?
Yes, he did come in third.
That is really surprising, don't you think, for an incumbent to finish third?
Oh, absolutely. Well, it's really surprising that you've got two Republican opponents in the primary when you're a sitting House member.
Usually that's a prescription for victory.
You would think. And you think that the Republican Party can control these guys to some degree. Like, what are you doing? He's a two- or three-term incumbent, and you're jumping in on him? And that didn't stop anybody, there was pressure from the party to say, don't go in against him. But they did. Rauscher had run against him 2 years ago and lost by about 100, 120, 150 votes, something like that. It was pretty close. And Culver is a tireless. He is tireless when it comes to campaigning, and he ran under the banner that he was a Republican, and he was going to build a lot of stuff and roads and all kinds of things like that, so he got himself out there, campaigned very hard, and winds up winning this thing. Plus, he's pretty well known there in the Massive Valley.
We can't resist this. We need to note it. Vic Coring is back.
Yes, he is. He did. He was in the Senate primary.
Senate race,
right?
Primary.
As an Alaska Independence Party member.
Right.
And wound up winning the primary. So we get to see Vic Coring again in November, right?
That's true.
And important to point out that he did campaign at least for one day on the side of the Glen Highway with a sign waving.
Yeah. That's his traditional method.
That's a traditional way of doing
Steve,
it.
Steve, it's surprising or astonishing as it is, there's other news in Alaska. there's news beyond the election. The city has yet another plan for dealing with the troubled port of Anchorage. What is it?
When this thing first started out years ago, it was going to be a massive expansion of the port. This is just a huge infrastructure for the state of Alaska. 90% of the goods that people eat, wear, drive, come through the port of Anchorage. So it was decided that it was going to be a big expansion project. There was a major problem with the construction where it was compromised the way it was being built. Work has stopped, and now the Mayor Sullivan has basically gotten all the user groups together, and they've hired CH2M Hill to come up with some alternatives. They've got four proposals on the table, and what to do next, what designs, and now it seems like it's gone from a massive expansion project to just sort of like, well, we're going to repair and maintain what we've got. And there may be some expansion, but it seems like that's the major tone of this right at this point.
And Mayor Sullivan, there's a good chance he will become our lieutenant governor.
Yep.
Does he become a lobbyist for Anchorage, or does he become, I'm busy with the elections and other lieutenant gubernatorial matters.
Well, I think they got a lot of time on their hands, those lieutenant governor folks. So I think he probably becomes a major lobbyist for Anchorage.
Okay.
I think
maybe he runs for Senate.
Maybe
he runs for Senate.
That's what the predecessor did.
I guess that would be a true first if we had two Dan Sullivans in both the U.S. Senate.
Yeah.
But first of all, there's Lisa Murkowski out there. Yeah. We're out of time. Thank you so much for joining us here on Alaska Edition. We'll see you next week, right here.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.